Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Me, Matt Beadle, here with the supported voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
Supported indeed, Matthew. This is slightly different. I'm going to say this evening. It is evening when we're recording this. Slightly different in that this isn't a feature pod. This isn't a between the sticks. This would sit somewhere in the middle. We haven't really thought of a name for this.
No, we haven't. We haven't. And actually, I was looking at the archives and it's been nearly, and I couldn't believe it when I saw this, it's been nearly 1 year since we last spoke to this individual. 17th of January 2021 it was.
That is crazy to think it's been that long, and actually a hell of a lot has happened between now and then. I mean, we could talk about the Euros, which he's involved in, but we're not going to talk about that, which I'm sure people would probably want us to ask about that. But we're not going to talk about that. We're not going to talk about the countless Premier League games that he's been playing between now and then. We are just going to have a very general goalkeeping chat. In fact, one that's going to be aimed, I would say, largely at younger goalkeepers, because we are going to be talking about gloves. We're going to be talking about the differences between young and old goalkeepers, how they train, how they need to be. We're going to be talking a bit about leadership as well. So hopefully we'll be able to pry all that knowledge out of his mind and come up with something half decent.
Absolutely. Well, he is waiting patiently on the line right now as you and I chat. So let's just get him involved. Kasper Schmeichel, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast again.
Thank you very much. I can't believe it's been that long.
Crazy, isn't it?
It's gone fast.
And we can just plow straight in now to talk gloves in particular. I want to start with gloves. And this has come off the back of the fact that you listened to the Neil Cutler podcast, which, of course, we did a few weeks ago. And Cuts being probably more of a goalkeeping geek than all three of us combined, I think it's fair to say. But he did talk a lot about gloves. And I think it's very few goalkeepers out there that don't have, I suppose it's almost a romanticism.
I love talking about gloves. I think I do genuinely think I could rival him for in terms of nerdiness.
Really?
Yeah, I listened to it and I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed the detail and how into it he was. It was a really enjoyable listen. I actually went for a walk and I was listening to it and ended up walking far too far, you know. But I had to finish it. So. Gloves have been, it's been something obviously in my life ever since I've remembered, because they were lying around at home. They were my dad's and they were size 12 and a halves. And wow. With my little hand, I used to try and get my hand in them. Used to scratch out his name, Peter and Tippex, and then try and write Casper over them when I was like 7, 8, 9 years old. Gloves were, I always dreamt of having gloves with my name on them or something, because that was what my dad had.
Do you know what? So, and I think I might mention this in Neil Cutler pod, and this just rings a bell. And I think it was via you, and I didn't know you at the time, the Vaseline on gloves. And I'm sure we spoke about this. That was it, you? Because I know that kind of spread in the goalkeeping world.
Gave Harty the credit for that, but I introduced that one to Harty as well. Yeah, it is such a weird thing that works, because it, like you said on the podcast, in theory shouldn't really work, should it? But that really does help. Again, it depends on the grip that you have and the ball that you're playing with. My current selection of gloves, I don't use it, but I did use it a lot particularly when I played in precision gloves, when I had the quartz palm, the Vaseline worked really, really well with that. But the level of detail that you can kind of go into with gloves is quite incredible. Yeah, it's quite incredible.
Have you ever had, so I only have had this a few times, where there were some days where you obviously prepare your gloves, I'm sure you wear, whether it's a new pair for every game or every couple of games or however you work.
I'm on the Brad Friedel. I basically wear a new pair every day.
Wow. You see, that baffles me.
Yeah, I do get through a copious amount of gloves during the year, purely because I think they're best. The ones that I'm wearing at the moment are best new.
Yeah.
Like I said, when I was with, for example, Precision Goalkeeping, we had the quartz palm. They needed to be worn a couple of times for them to be good. But when I switched to Adidas, they have the 1.0 grip and the 2.0 grip. The 1.0 is to date the best grip that I've used, but it's also one game and they're done. Like, they're absolutely finished. You know, I find it a bit grotesque that they sell them because they are so, they're so good, but like I say, they're just done after an hour and a half's work. And I can't, you know, they're so expensive. So I always used to train in the 2.0s to maximize, so I could use them, you know, two or three times, and then always played the game in the 1.0. And I used glove glue on them, and they were phenomenal. They're absolutely phenomenal. Had to change for the Euros. Euros was a 2.0 because the 1.0 didn't work that well with the Adidas ball. We had a situation in the World Cup where I've been in the 1.0s all season, got to the World Cup, got to the training camp, and it was like a bar of soap. I couldn't get these 1.0s to work. So I had to get Adidas to make up a whole new batch of 2.0s because they were much better with that ball. And then for the round of 16, they changed the ball to, instead of being black and white, it was red, black and white. And it was a completely different grip on it. And all of a sudden, the 2.0s didn't work. So we had to get the 1.0 back. Same thing happened at the Euros. For the semi-final, they used a silver ball. And that ball was completely different. Like, the ball we used for the group stages and the quarters and all that, that's the best ball I've ever played with. Without question, the best ball to strike and the best grip, everything was perfect with it. And then they changed it for the semi-final to a silver ball. And I remember 2 days before we got the balls to train with, and they were like a bar of soap. They were horrendous. So we obviously had to fly to England, and my gloves got stuck in customs after Brexit. So I couldn't get any gloves to work on this ball. So I had to play with the ones I had, and it was awful. It was really, really awful. Well,
that's ridiculous.
I was going to ask you this because that was the exact question. So I remember a plane. I still remember, because I remember the feeling of not being able to find a pair of gloves that went. It was an FA Cup game. I can't remember who it was actually against, but it was basically because they'd used the FA Cup balls. And at the time, we were Mitre at the time, I think Championship Mitre, the FA Cup. And I had always have three pairs with me, all brand new. One that had been washed, one that hadn't, one that, you know, was a little bit worn. So I thought, well, one of them will work with this. But when I could, for the life of me, I couldn't. Bar of soap. And instantly for me going into that game, my mindset shifted a bit. And it was, well, I'm not going to be able to catch the ball today. So I'm going to be parrying for fun. I'm going to be punching. And the confidence, or the lack of confidence in that. So if you're going into a game, the biggest game, or arguably one of the biggest games, the biggest game of your career, right? You're going into that.
Certainly one of them, yeah.
Yeah, and you're playing a game, yeah, maybe, in fairness, you played a hell of a lot of big games, but you're going to a game and you've got that bar of soap. How did you, how do you deal with that?
To be fair, it's like the last little percentage. I back my handling with anything. I'll back them without gloves. So I weren't too fussed about that. The one thing I will say, and it might sound strange and people might not, you know, who don't understand goalkeeping might not believe it, but I do believe with the other ball, if we'd have played with the previous ball, not the silver ball, I'd have been able to hold Harry's penalty.
Really?
That would have made a difference for sure, because that ball was so slippy. It was incredible. And I felt I had to really get something behind it to stop it. I didn't want to take the chance of having to catch it. So I was trying to trap it, which makes a slight bit of difference. But yeah, that, like you said, with the FA Cup, and then you have the Carabao Cup, then you have the Europa League, and you have the Premier League. So it's four different balls, and they're all ridiculously, take the Nike ball in the Premier League at the moment. That's the worst ball they've ever made. Like, it's an awful, awful football compared to what they have made in the past. Like, two seasons ago, they made an incredible ball. But if you notice this one, it's so hard, for example, to do the sidewinder to get it far. It's really, really difficult to do that. And it's a much more, I'd call it like a moody ball, because it doesn't always do what you want it to do. And particularly when you try and hit it hard, it won't really work. And the Adidas one was just so true. With that, I was kicking goal. I could take goal kicks and I could land on the edge of the other box. With the Nike one, I can barely get over the halfway line sometimes, particularly if it's cold. you know, then it really changes. And then you have the Europa League one, which is a bit like the Adidas one that just flies. Then you have the Puma now in the Carabao Cup, which is, wow, that is like, that's a bit like the Jabalani of 2010. And what you got, the FA Cup, that's the Mitre ball, which again, that's a strange ball because it's got great grip on it, but it feels so heavy and it moves a lot in the air. But you can also really hit it far. So that's a kind of a bit, yeah, you've got some good things about it and some bad things about it. So yeah, four different balls. Then you go to internationals. You'll play with select balls in Denmark. You'll play with whatever ball some country that you're playing against will play with there. So for me, I've always had gloves of different grips, and I'll make sure that I have different ones available to me just in case whatever ball that we're playing with, because you usually get it the day before to practice with, just in case one of them doesn't work, then you always have a backup.
Surely then, I mean, this is unbelievable. Surely, so you're saying, you know, 5 to 7 different balls and as a result, different glove combinations you're having to use to deal with these balls. Surely there has to be some across the board regulation to deal with this. I don't know whether it's the same for outfield players and they struggle with the balls as much as goalkeepers might have to, but surely that should come into place.
They do. I mean, like I said, the Nike ball, I've not heard a Premier League player say anything good about it yet. Compared to, for example, at the Euros, you actually noticed people saying, wow, this is what a great ball, that you could really hit that so nicely. I think you see also in the quality of play, for example, switches of play are difficult with a Nike ball, whereas the Adidas balls you see in the Champions League, you can hit diags, you can hit, you know, it's just so much easier to hit. But there is a FIFA standard, but I think, I'm not sure really. I mean, and I'm sure like Nike and Adidas, you know, they'll have all sorts of stats and numbers to back up that this ball is the best ball or whatever. But again, it comes down to taste. The Nike ball we have in the Premier League at the moment has really good grip on it. I'll say that for it. Yeah, it's just not a ball that has worked well. It's got these grooves in it. I think it's called like Aero something or other. But I think it's been something they've tested and tried, and for me, it hasn't really worked. What they had before was so good, so good. So it's a shame they've kind of changed. I hope they go back and see that the other one was better. But yeah, gloves wise, you've got to be prepared for all sorts. And like I said, I worked with Adidas for a while who produced my gloves. I didn't have a contract with them. I don't want to have a contract with, I don't want to be bound to wearing something specific. But they produced great gloves for me for a long time. And then they went to this newish one where they, you know, without the strap, they produced mine with a strap, but it went so far up my arm and it took so long to get on. Like it was ridiculous. I kept asking them, please, can you not just go back to making it was probably the best glove I've ever worn, the one they made before. And they just wouldn't do it. We're sticking with this. We want everyone to be wearing this. So in the end, I just started looking to other opportunities, spoke to lots of different companies about just producing my own glove. I hated having to constantly change colors and constantly changing all this kind of, I'm old school. I like a simple glove. I wear negative cut with a little bit of a rolled thumb. I have two finger saves in the two middle fingers of each glove. Yeah, I like just like an old school fit with a simple strap, not too much going on. And they made that brilliantly for a number of years for me. But then when they wouldn't change, I thought, well, I've got to find something that I like. And I spoke to Dave Sanderson, the guy who made my gloves for Precision back in the day. I came up with some ideas, some of the gloves that I liked, you know, sent him some of the images that I liked. I liked the simplicity of them and he knew the construction that I liked. So he made a load of them for me and I just bought them like anyone else would. I just got them to make them and buy them. And I did the same with the Ullsport. I asked them, I loved their grip. I loved the super soft grip that they had. Spent a lot of time testing. Like the 6 months leading up to the Euros was, you know, I just basically went on goalkeeper websites, bought gloves from all sorts of different companies and just tried whatever grips they kind of had and what worked best. And so Ullsport agreed to produce these gloves for me. And again, I just went and bought them from them. And they're the ones that I'm wearing now. So yeah, that's kind of my history of it.
Do you know what? And it's going to take us into a few different paths, I'm sure, but it's the level of detail. And I know we touched on this before, probably in the previous pod that we did, but the level of detail, again, young goalkeepers listening to this now, who some might not even wash their gloves after a game, let alone think of the amount of things you've gone into there. What I also love as well is you mentioned Dave Sanderson, that the goalkeeping glove world is quite a small world. Like,
it's a very small world.
It's such a small world. And you've got is it Bob Fiddler at Royce? You've got Adam Sells, of course, Sells goalkeeper gloves. You've got Miles Leighton, does the Wong glove. You've kind of got like five or six key figures in the glove world that you go back to. But also the fact that you mentioned there, and that's a really interesting point for me, that, of course, there's glove sponsorships out there. No doubt you could choose any of these brands and they will pay you for wearing the gloves. But the whole thing being that actually this is so important to you. You know, this is a different. You mentioned that detail earlier that had it been a different ball, who knows, it might have been a different outcome in that particular moment, because it is such a fine line when it comes to doing what you do. So if you're going to be paid X amount to wear a pair of gloves that doesn't quite suit you and you're going to be bound into a contract to have to wear them, to actually make the decision, I would assume, I don't know, all, you know, 20 odd starting Premier League goalkeepers, more than that, obviously lads sitting on the bench, etc. How many would actually go without a paid contract just to make sure they are wearing a pair that suits them? That's quite unique.
Yeah, I mean, for me, my gloves are my tools. They're so important. And it's no good that every time I'm putting a glove on that I'm annoyed at something, you know, I'm wishing they were different or something like that. Like I said, Adidas for many years made the best glove. Like, it was such a good glove and there was no need for them to change. But obviously they wanted to progress to this strapless glove, which is all the rage at the moment. And, you know, I was trying to explain to them, you know, I'm old school like that. I grew up with, you know, flat palm, you know, one on top of the other, nothing fancy at all. That's how I grew up. And I'm not a fan of these that take forever to put on and they go halfway up your arm and they've got all these spikes on. The spikes cost me a goal against Tottenham last day of the season. I came out for a punch on the wet. And this rubber that's on them is great when the ball's dry because you can get, you know, real good grip and purchase on it. But when it's wet, it just slides straight off. And that's exactly what happened. You know, it just slides straight off. I got a decent enough contact on it, but it just slid straight off the rubber because the rubber was wet and the ball was wet. So I thought, I can't be doing with this. I can't be having to, you know, beg these people to make the gloves how I want them. So I've got to take responsibility for that myself. So went on the market and just had a look around. And also all this, I hate doing photo shoots. I hate doing all that. I can't stand all the time it takes to stand and pose with gloves, and you got to pose every time there's a new colorway and all that. It just wasn't for me. I did all that and I found out it just wasn't for me. So I thought, I'd rather buy my own gloves and they'd be mine and I don't have to promote them. I don't have to do anything other than just enjoy wearing them. And that was what I did.
I was going to say, you absolutely shouldn't have to compromise with something so important. And I guess just with what you're saying before, Rich, you come in, just with what you're saying on the different balls and the different gloves you're having to use, are you then also saying, so that punch, for example, if that happened again and you were wearing those gloves, are you having to alter the way you are as a goalkeeper as well? So sometimes where you might punch, instead you'll catch. Sometimes instead where you might parry, you might try and catch, and vice versa.
Yeah, I think, like Rich was saying before, if you have a game, for example, where you're not feeling 100% about the glove or the grip on it, if you have a warm-up where you're thinking, this ain't right, then you will maybe punch more, or you will maybe not try and catch through bodies or something like that. So I think particularly in my younger days, that did kind of affect how you played. Now, luckily, I feel I've got to a point with my gloves that I can basically take them straight out of the pack and they work with most balls and it's not really an issue. So, yeah, I think previously, yeah, it would have made a difference, but now not so much.
The point I was going to make is I didn't think we could go a level up on the Neil Cutler goalkeeping geekiness, but I think we've actually taken the glove chat a level further here.
We can go so much deeper. I mean, I can, you know, when I was a kid, I used to draw the designs that I wanted, and I used to try all sorts of things that I wanted, and you know, I was so lucky that I had goalkeepers all around me. Like, I obviously had my dad and all the gloves, all the Roche gloves he wore. To then at his final season, he wore the Nike glove. I don't know if you remember, Nike produced probably the best looking glove ever made. Was their first VG3, the all white with a black tick and the silver strap. For me, just the best looking glove ever. And my dad wore them, but they gave them to him too early, apparently, so they weren't released. They had this other one, which was black with orange on the back. And my dad, being nearly 40, said, you know, he's never worn anything but white gloves, you know. So he was like, nah, I can't. I just can't get my head around not having white gloves on. And I remember he actually just said, right, well, just make me something without any brand. So he just wore plain white, nothing on them. So he wore them until the other ones were released, and then he wore them. But I used to, I saw when David Seaman came to Man City, his Puma glove actually got me in with Puma. And Puma produced a great glove for me. And I remember coming through, it was the first glove with my name on it. So like they printed my name on it. And that was like, I know it's not a big thing anymore, but back in the day, like you have to deserve to get it. You have to make yourself worthy of having your name on your gloves. You know, it was a big time Charlie or whatever it was who had his name on his boots or his gloves. And I remember my dad being very kind of, not strict, because that's not the word, said, you've got to be deserving of having it. And you haven't, you know, if you haven't played a first team game, you shouldn't have your name on your gloves, kind of thing. That was I know it's changed now, it's completely different, but that was how the attitude was back then. And I was being coached by, you know, Peter Benetti, Tim Flowers, these guys, old school guys that would be of the same opinion as my dad. So I remember I got these and I was buzzing about them. I was wearing them, looking, these look phenomenal and all that kind of thing. And I remember actually taping over my name just so that they didn't see it. You know, so when I made my league debut for Darlington, you know, I actually in the dressing room, I taped over my name because I didn't want anyone thinking that, you know, I was big time or anything like that, because that was what you'd be seen as back then if you had your name on your gloves. Yeah, that's again. I just always looked at other keepers' gloves. I always looked at Hartey's gloves, and I always, like, Shea had these gloves, which are very similar to mine now. He had finger saving all of his, but negative cut, and kind of that, you know, I tried one of his pairs once and they were great, you know. So I kind of took my lead off that. I got a pair of Thomas Sorensen gloves when I was probably about 14. I think they're called Nike Kraken or something like that. And they were they were the first pair of negative cut gloves. Until then, I'd only ever worn flat palm, and that was like a revolution for me. This, it just felt unbelievable catching with these. So yeah, it was. There's so many. Yeah, we can talk for hours about this. Well, and
the thing is, you know, all those gloves you name, like, each time, and it's funny because I see like the smile on your face. I remember, for me, it might be before your time, but it was the SMGs, the SRGs, the Sondicos. And that was it for me as a kid. And then it was, then when the Adidas Finger Saves first came out, and it was the green and black. And that was...
Oh, yeah. I had them.
Yeah,
I had
that, them. They were... Although from memory, the grip wasn't great, but I love the look of the glove.
We played with Select Balls back in Denmark, and it was actually really good on them.
Was it?
Yeah. But yeah, we lived... When I lived in Portugal... I don't know if you've ever seen the MPH glove, Michel Poudon.
Yeah.
So back in the day, everyone wore them in Portugal. And Michel Poudon, being, you know, who he is, he lived on the same street as us. And I remember he dropped gloves off to my dad one day to say, you know, do you want to try them? And he was under contract with Roche, so he couldn't. So I was wearing them in the garden, and they were brilliant as well. But again, it's just, they were all produced in the same factory. They're all the same cut. Everything was the same, just a different design on them back then. But yeah, I remember they were the first pair of aqua gloves. That, you know, the blue palm. That was the first time I tried that. Then once I was given a pair of Select gloves, which had a blue palm on. And I actually wore them when I was on trial at Man United when I was young. And it was the worst decision I ever made, because they... Honestly, they were so slippy. It was a nightmare. So I didn't wear them after that. So yeah. To me, the old school kind of grips, not too much going on, are the ones that I like.
I could see this being a future path for you, Casper. By the way, although the thing is, from what you're saying, it's going to be like real old school gloves Like, do you know, but I, that's what I mean. I could see it being really popular. I bet there's a lot of goalkeepers listening right now saying 100%. I was like, my whole career, I was a sales rapper. And I must have had that for 10 years, the same pair of gloves. Because like you said there, do you know what? I found it. I liked it. It was the, yeah. And in the end, I had white boots in the end. But I've basically black boots, white gloves for my whole career. And now it's...
I can't do black boots.
They're, no.
Why? I started my career in them because you had to wear them.
Mm.
But I don't know. It came from Cañizares, if you remember him. He wore white boots and he wore, you know, he just looked, he had this aura about him. And back then, if you're a keeper, if I bowled up to an academy session in white boots or something, I'd have been told in no uncertain terms to get them off instantly. And I remember the first time I wore a pair of white boots to training, like people, like some of the first team is looking at what are you wearing? Get them off right now. You know, so it was something you had to be deserving of. You had to be some player. You've got to be some goalkeeper to wear white boots. And, you know, when you've got old school goalie coaches like your Tim Flowers, you know, they're just looking at you, shaking your head.
Yeah. That goes against, though, doesn't it? The traditional nature of what you're saying. Like, you like the traditional goalie gloves, but you don't like black boots. That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, boots, again, that's always been another passion of mine. Always loved football boots. I've practically saved every pair I've used for the last 10 years or so. You know, Kitman hates me. Kitman absolutely. I take up a good third of his kit room, and it's a big kit room with just my boots at the moment. So yeah, I need to get rid of them at some point. But yeah, I just always love boots as well. But it's white boots, but bright colours for some reason. I feel light, I feel quicker in them. If I wear black boots, it just feels wrong. I feel heavy. Yeah, it doesn't suit me, I think.
That was it back in the day. Because that you're right, it was probably similar to yourself where it was the fine, but it was not only black boots, because we get the Adidas voucher. Yeah, this is something that, again, as a YT, as an academy player, you get the Adidas voucher. So everyone...
Oh, it turned into Nike.
Ah, you see, this is showing my age. Because that was it. Then everyone rocked up in the same Adidas tracksuit the next day. And they all had to... And we were told we had to have Copas and World Cups, which, I mean, Copas and World Cups, they are what they are. But in terms of being like a stylish goalkeeper, no disrespect to that boot, but if you're wearing a pair of World Cups, you're not necessarily going to fit into that category. But it was, that was it. It was the Adidas voucher.
Oliver Kahn's and them lot, they wore World Cups, so I wore them as well. Mm. I say I was probably 21 before I wore a pair of coloured boots. The World Cups, I love them, and them and the Copas and the Tiempos, the first generations, they're just phenomenal. And we had to wear Tiempos at Man City. We always had to wear Tiempos. Yeah, they were a great boot. They're just a great boot. And I don't know why, I just can't wear them anymore. When we train on the AstroTurf in the Dome, The physios want us to wear round studs because obviously the blades, if you try and turn, you can catch your knee and all that. And a couple of times I've worn Copas in there and it just feels so weird. And you see other lads wearing Copas and it just looks so wrong. And for some reason, it just looks so wrong. You look like a coach, don't you? But yeah, I don't know. They are the best boot, without question, the most comfortable boot. But if they made them in all white, then maybe.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Michael saves. Kane is there to follow in. It's a brilliant save from Kasper Schmeichel, but he must not have believed his luck. He's done everything he can possibly do tonight.
Something I do want to talk to you about is one of the things we're going to talk about is leadership. And this, for me, when you we exchanged some messages earlier, when you mentioned this, straight away my mind went to, again, young goalkeepers. Not just young, actually, because I know this certainly applies all the way through, and it can be personality, it can be character when it comes to leadership, and actually the role that you have to play as a goalkeeper and the importance of being a leader, regardless of whether you're captain, not, you know, your role within the team, having to, you know, especially with your back four, back five, the amount of communication, the amount of authority that you need to have to play the role. But made me think of young goalkeepers coming through and to have the ability to be that leader at a young age, you know, and certainly from the last podcast and getting to know you, it's certainly something you don't struggle with. You know, I get the impression that you'll be incredibly assertive in the dressing room, those around you. Have you always had that? Has that been something that you've had to work on? Do you have advice for young goalkeepers on that?
I mean, I think leadership is probably one of the things that interests me the most because of how much it's changed over the years. So when I started, you know, it was basically coming out of my father's generation, the shouty, big mouth, really, really, you know, hard leaders. And the amount of times I look back at old footage and look at myself shouting and screaming, I'm thinking, I don't even know what I'm saying. This was what the coaches were telling you back then. You've got to be commanding, you've got to be this. And looking back now, I just think, shut up. There's no need. And even now I see keepers shouting and screaming and bawling after certain situations. I'm thinking, what are you actually saying? Because leadership has changed, and particularly being a goalkeeper, because like I say, there was my dad's generation of you know, which really started something off of keepers have to be this, you know, really loud, brash, you've got to have personality. That was what they always say. I want to hear you. Whereas then kind of my generation of keepers looking up to was the Casillases. And you look at Casillas, how little he actually reacted after certain situations. He was just ice cool. But he was always captain of Madrid and he was captain of Spain. So he must have been doing something else. So that was the kind of thing I was looking at. Because my first kind of influences of captains were my dad, were Oliver Kahn, Cañizares, these guys who were huge personalities and they're so volatile in their way of communicating, so aggressive. And I think now, looking back, if I'm a first team player and I'm hearing this 18-year-old keeper shouting and screaming like I was doing, I'm thinking, what is going on? Calm down. I need calmness behind me. I need someone who's in control. And that's where I think leadership's changed, because that was leadership 20 years ago. That was how it was seen and perceived. Now it's completely different. Look how cool you've got to be as a keeper, how, you know, you've got to be the guy who sees everything now, and you've got to be the guy who has perspective on things. And there's no question that there is a time and a place to not lose your cool, but to really be assertive in your communication and the way you communicate it. But I think now it tends to be more in the dressing room rather than in front of people, because I think nowadays it gives the wrong impression. It gives an impression that you're flustered or there's something like this. So I try really hard to be as level-headed and as calm as I can on the pitch. Sometimes it doesn't work because it's an emotional game, you know, and adrenaline's kicking and all that. But it's something I've really, really worked on over the years of trying to calm. It's something I started working with a guy who was a general in the Danish military. Someone whose book I read who really inspired me. It was a leadership book, and I got in contact with him. I went to one of his seminars, and you know, I was blown away how this guy communicated, how this guy talked, the level of passion, but also how precise and how clear he was in every message. So I started working with him because I had this dream. I wanted to be a captain, and I think I had the qualities to be a captain, but there wasn't really a direction, and I wanted to be much clearer in my kind of messages, and I wanted to learn how to speak properly. So I started working with him, and that helped me so many ways because it gave me so many different perspectives on communication, on leadership. And it's something that we work on to this day. There are certain situations that I'll speak to him about. And I think the most important thing about leadership and what I've found is to be genuine. Just be yourself. I think if you're acting, people will see through it. And particularly when you're in a group like a football club where you're together all the time, if you're acting, at some point, the cracks will show. So it's about being genuine. And the thing that really struck me the most about leadership is you're serving. You know, you're there to serve your team. You're there to be a servant to whatever the team needs to get the team to where you want to go. So that's really my role. It's not me that's got to stand. We've got to do this. This is how we do. you've got to take on the role of a kind of a practical psychologist and see how you get the best out of each individual, because the screaming and bawling thing, it just doesn't work. You've got to have that in you, because every now and then you've got to show your teeth as well, because there are certain situations where, you know, you've got to be really, really harsh and really, really tough. And you've got to sometimes look, not lose your head, but you've got to look really passionate about what it is you're trying to say. But it's really important that you find a tone that you set every single day, and you lead in your own way. Everyone leads in their own way. For me, it's about being there for the team, whatever the team needs. You know, if I feel the team needs a day off, and I won't go in and just say, oh, I feel this. I'll listen around the dressing room what the lads are feeling, you know, not necessarily speaking to them, but I, you know, you hear the conversations around, and you make your kind of your decisions from that, and you discuss with probably your vice captain or your leadership group or however it works. Like I say, you're just there. You're there for your team, whatever the team needs, the team around you, what they need. And it's a huge responsibility, and it's not something that I take lightly. And it's something I spend a lot of time on discussing with various people. I'm so lucky that I've grown up with a lot of keepers that are retired now who were captains themselves, that I can bounce ideas off and get different kind of inputs. But it's something that I do spend a great deal of time thinking about, and how do I become the best leader possible.
Do you know what? I'm fascinated by this, because I think, again, as a goalkeeper, the amount of time you can spend on the technical, the tactical, the physical, etc. But actually, this is something that not just goalkeepers, outfield players, how much time would someone spend understanding communication, which is effectively a lot of what you've just said there. It's the ability to communicate, because look, we've all seen and we've all been in teams where you've got players on the pitch that are acting for the fans. You know, the ones that will come and, as you say about being genuine to be a leader, you've got the opposite of that, which might be the guy that's going around patting you on the back when you made a mistake, looking like he's trying to help you, when actually all he's doing is highlighting the fact that you've made a mistake. You know, whereas actually leadership, communication, serving those around you, understanding what you can do in a given moment to genuinely help that person. And I remember, I watched your dad a lot as a kid. I was, you know, United fan, used to go to some of the games. So then I would model my game around that. But I didn't know why I was doing what I was doing. I would be the one that the ball would go wide. I would sprint to the edge of the box and start screaming at someone. For what reason? Why was I doing it? But it was because at the time, you're right, that was how it was. But I never fully understood what I was doing, why I was doing it. And it's only... obviously, my past's been a bit different. But certainly now, everything you've just said there, and look... You know, for all goalkeepers listening to this, I suppose for all the bits you'll take from this, I'm sure there'll be a lot of glove goodness that they'll take from this. But I think the communication side of things for me, the bit that I learned early on was, so communication isn't what's said, it's what's received. So understanding that when you're talking to someone, you've got to be talking in such a way that they are taking in that information. Again, if you can have that with your back four, how important that will be, how powerful that will be. You know, it's the cliches that we've heard 100 times, that you can see the entire pitch, you can be their eyes and ears. But actually, that starts with having effective leadership, effective communication with those around you.
Yeah, and communication and clarity and delivery of the message, something that I've really, really worked on. So obviously, I listened to my guy and how he spoke. And that was really what drew me to him, is how a military general, this guy... is getting people to die for him, literally. And they do it. How do you lead like that? Like, how do you actually get people to go that far for you? And I listened to, for example, Chris Voss from the Black Swan Group, listened to a lot of what he says, the tone of your voice, the smooth radio DJ, kind of the old, you know, getting into people, or you've got different pitches talking to different people, because a football game, there is levels of stress. I've been told that, for example, on a penalty shootout in a major tournament, the level of stress exerted upon a penalty taker is the same level of stress as taking fire. That is a hell of a lot of stress to take, you know? So what can you do to minimize that for your guy and maximize that for the guy you're facing? You know, how do you communicate to these guys who are under such pressure? So you've got to learn what each individual has. And you talked about, you know, running to the edge of the box and screaming and shouting, because that was how it was done back then. I also think you've got to look at the personalities in that team. you know, your Steve Bruce's, your Gary Pallister's, and your Yap Stam later on, these guys, they could take that and they could give it back just as much. Whereas now it's different. You don't talk to people like that anymore. So you've got to be, you know, take, for example, my communication with Johnny Evans. Johnny's come through Man United and has an old school element to him. We can exchange views quite frankly. And, you know, when the final whistle goes, we're hugging each other, we're mates, you know. But on the pitch, we can get after each other. I had the same with Wes Morgan, with Robert Huth, with Martin Vasilevsky. But someone like Kags, for example, who where English is his second language, you know, I've got to be very precise in the words that I use. I've got to be clear in the words that I use, particularly early on. His English is great now, but particularly in the early days and with Wesley Fofana, you've got to sometimes even learn in French what, you know, à gauche, à droite, you know, these kind of things to try and help him in a certain situation, because he's not speaking that the same language as me. So we got to find a common language that we can both speak. It is so much about the delivery of that message, and leadership can be many different things. My dad was a leader in his way. I had a goalkeeper coach who sadly passed away last week, my goalkeeper coach for Denmark, who was a leader in his complete own way, you know, but polar opposites, but both worked really, really well. So there's no kind of set leader, I think, anymore. Like I said, I think back in the day, it was the you know, the shouty guy, the big, you know, the one who, you know, stuck his chest out and was you know, facing forward, and you know, all this kind of thing. So I think you got to be genuine and find your own style, and it's taking time, and it is taking time. I don't feel you're ever the finished article. I'm certainly nowhere near, but you're there to serve. You're there to make your team better, and however you do that, that's something for you to figure out. But I think finding people to model yourself on and to be inspired by, but also to bounce idea off, is really, really important. You know, I have my book that you know, I write stuff down in.
What does that say on the front there? What does that say?
It's the High Performance Institute back in Denmark. You know, so I write my ideas down at certain points, and I'll be able to go back, you know, a year back or 2 years back, and look at, you know, what I was feeling at a certain point. If we're if we're somewhere in a season that's maybe difficult or great, you go back to the times where it was difficult or great, and you think, right, these were the things that I had in my head back then. You know, maybe we need to get back to this, or maybe we need to keep doing this. You know, there's things that you can take from those parallels. And I just think it's always been important for me to kind of get these things out and use them in the future.
It's funny because I'm looking up at my phone now, because on my phone, probably similar to that, where the idea of actually getting stuff like that down, again, this comes back to development, comes back to that continued learning. But I suppose the thing will be is you'll have something that will be that powerful to you. Like for anyone that's read these types of books as well, like you'll always pick something up. But of course, during the time you're reading it, you're thinking, I'm never going to forget this. This is the way forward now. But naturally, we're drawn back to the way that we were before.
Yeah.
So then to continue to move forward. So my strategy is always, I'll make the notes on my phone. I've got it in a recurring folder, basically, that every week comes up. No joke, I must have 400 notes that come up every week. But it's just, it takes, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes.
And exactly the same.
Have you got the same thing? And it's,
I know exactly the same thing, yeah. Yeah, and I write, you know, if I hear something I like, I'll write it down. I hear quotes or anything like that, something that I like, I'll always have it down. I love the NFL. I think the NFL is so unique in the sense that so much revolves around one man on the team, in the quarterback. And I think the goalkeeping can correlate to that a little bit because of the responsibility that one person has. Goalkeeping can kind of relate a bit to that kind of responsibility, where if you don't perform, your team is not going to perform. And I look at their reactions to mistakes. I look at their reactions to great bits of play and how composed they are, how cool they are. And my favorite has always been Tom Brady and Peyton Manning. And those two have been massive, massive inspirations for me. The longevity they showed, but the tactical intelligence they have in their profession, but also their body language, how they conduct themselves. Brady's still at 44, how he conducts himself, how Manning conducted himself, their preparation, how meticulous they are. they know every single run, they know everything that's going to happen, and they just execute. They just execute, and if they don't, there's no facial reaction. They move on, just move on. You know, and that's something that I really try to learn from, is just move on to the next. We've got to move on all the time.
Do you think this then comes back to, I can't remember if we talked about this before, but if we didn't, I'm sure that we'll go quite deep on it. Having a process-based mindset, you know, where you kind of, and I guess this comes back to football being as romantic as it can often be, and the highs, the lows, the emotions that you get from watching, playing football. But you often see a lot of these ones you're talking about, and you've used that expression before about being ice cold. And a lot of it seems to be a process, like you say, meticulous in everything that you do, the build up, the preparation, everything. There's always an area that can be improved. And that mentality of, if it can be improved, it must be improved. That kind of idea. And then it becomes the process. And of course, when you then go out on the game day, it's completely uncertain as to how it's going to go. Now, more often than not, if you do prepare like this, you will have a positive day, you would think, more often than not. However, things will, of course, go wrong. And you see it. As you say, they are great examples, the ones you've given there. Where things go wrong, you wouldn't necessarily know. You're not seeing them screaming, shouting. And the reason I say all this is, look, I was one of those goalkeepers. If I made a mistake, you'd know I made a mistake because you'd see it. You know, I remember watching several games that I played, and you could see the expression, the pained expression in my face, because in that moment, I felt emotional in that moment. Yet I watch the likes of yourself. I watch, you know, the best goalkeepers. And Edison's another great example, where just so cool. Just so cool. Whether he's made a great save or a bad mistake, there's no change.
And again, I'm still a product of that generation, so it will sometimes creep back into me. But yeah, it's definitely something that when you are young, when I was young, it was very raw passion. Because you want it so much, you don't always know how to control that. And I think back then I ran on emotion, and I played on emotion, and I played on impulse. And through the years, you learn that analytical approach will, in the long run, serve you better. Because emotionally, football is so draining. It's so draining to play, conceding goals and making mistakes and making great saves, the roller coaster of emotions, it's so draining on you personally that I don't think you can do it for a full 20-year career if you're that lucky to have a 20-year career. But so you adopt this analytical approach, and I think if you can adopt, the earlier you can adopt that, the better you'll be for it. I always say to the young keepers, because the young keepers we have at Leicester, you know, love them. Their attitude is phenomenal. You know, they train so hard. They train so well. But when they make a mistake, you'll hear it, because they'll get angry at themselves. And I was exactly like that. Exactly. I'd be kicking posts. I'd be throwing water bottles. I'd be fuming. Everyone on the training ground would know I'd made a mistake. Tim Flowers used to always say to me, just, you don't need to show them. We know if you've made a mistake, and you know if you've made a mistake. So move on. Move on. And I keep saying it to the youngsters. They'll even make a save and they'll get angry with themselves. And I'll be like, mate, none of us here know what you were trying. So have that in your own head and move on. Don't let us know that you've made a mistake, because we don't know you've made a mistake. We don't know if you were trying to do exactly that. So style it out. Make it look as if that was exactly what I wanted to do. I'm in complete control. Because the last thing that your defenders need is to be looking back and thinking, but what's going on here? You know, is he losing it, kind of thing? You know, you need to be a rock. You need to be there for your team. You need to be the calm one in the storm, because their pulses, you know, are up in the 90%, 95% mark a lot of the game. And it's difficult to make decisions back then. Your pulse won't be there. So you have a much more unique vantage point of the pitch, but you also have the advantage of not being as pumped of adrenaline, because you all know that mistakes happen when your pulse is at its highest. That's when it's difficult to make decisions. Whereas our pulse ain't there. So our decision-making is very different. So we have to transmit that to them and give them the calmness that we're in control. So when you make a mistake that might not be a mistake, just style it out, you know, absolutely style it out. And it was great to see the likes of David Seaman, you know, even in training when he conceded a goal, no reaction, just right. And sometimes you just say, I'd have got that in a game, you know, and that was him moving on, just moved on. Yep, got that one in a game. And that was it. Whereas we'd be kicking and screaming and being annoyed and all this. But again, I think that goes back to when you're young, you just, you want it so much. You want to show how good you are. So any mistake you make, you get frustrated with yourself because it's such an uncertain time of your life because you're trying to make it into professional football. And it means so much to you that you want to show how much it means. And then when things go wrong, this reaction, I think, is natural. So obviously getting to a professional stage, you know, that's when you've got to start performing. That's when you've got to be a little bit more selfish and you've got to look at yourself and how you are best preparing for the game. And, you know, there's no right or wrong. Some keepers watch hundreds of clips of this, that and the other. And some people just put the gloves on and go out and play. Both things I've seen work for many different keepers. For me personally, it was all about repetition when I was young. Constant repetition. I feel now at 35, so confident that I have that much in the bank that I could, if I was injured, I had a period, particularly the season we won the league, you know, my back was gone. My back was finished. I couldn't walk during the week. I didn't train at all. I literally just put the gloves on, got a couple of numbing injections and played the game. And then I was done for the rest of the week, did the same week after. And I did that for probably 3 or 4, maybe 5 weeks. You know, but I felt I had that much experience. I had that much baggage with me to know that I could just rock up and play at a high level. That's something that only comes with age, because that first bit of your career, you've got to take every training session you possibly can. You've got to be asking coaches for more, and you've got to tell sometimes the sports science guys to do one. I'm training afternoon, I'm training morning, I'm training night with the under 16s if I have to. I did that when I was at Man City. I trained with the first team in the morning, the under 18s in the afternoon, and the under 16s at night. You know, I'd go from Carrington training with Tim Flowers up to Andy Rhodes at the academy, and I'd join in at night. You know, I'd do 3 sessions a day, making sure that, you know, I had everything prepared, that I was ready to go. And I think that's obviously where time then evolves, when you get old. You can't train that much. You can't train 3 times a day like that. It's just not physically possible, because at the end of the day, the games are the important thing. So you got to learn how to manage your body and, you know, how much can you train. And there's certain sessions where, you know, if you're doing shooting sessions after an hour and a half training, where, you know, I just have to say to the youngsters, you take this, because that's just, I've got a game in 2 days and I need to be fresh for that. That's my bread and butter. That's the game. Whereas they don't have a game, so they need those reps. And I took anything I could back then, and I would stay out for hours and hours. Any outfielder that wanted a bit of shooting, I was there. I was ready, and I loved it. You know, loved being able to face some of the best players, some of the best strikers, and you develop a great relationship with some of the strikers, that, because it becomes a little competition between yourselves. And again, that's a way for a young keeper to establish themselves in a first team. We've got this, the situation with Jakub Stolarczyk now at Leicester, who's a 21-year-old keeper who has everything that you want in a keeper. And lads now, because we, Eldin, for example, has pulled his calf. He's been in training with the first team now for probably five weeks now, and they're seeing what we've seen, and they're now starting to realize this kid's good. This kid is really good, and that kind of gets you in with the first team. His issue now is he's reached a level now where he is so good, he needs to play games now. So he has to get out and play now, because you will reach a point where you will stagnate. And that can be very disheartening. I reached it at Man City, you know, where you're just training every day. There's no reward at the end of it. You're not training towards a goal of playing. And that is so important from that, probably 18 to 22, 23, get out and play. Get out and play. It's so important, because training you can do, you know, you can do that all day. Mistakes, no real consequences for it. Games where, you know, livelihoods are on the line, that's where it matters. And that's when you have that, you know, those years of from probably 14 to 20 of constant repetitions. And then you go out and show and prove, you know, what you've been learning.
that's what we've been talking about recently in the Between the Sticks as well, isn't it? That number three and the lack of at some clubs and some players not getting the opportunities.
That role is, for me, has the highest respect ever, because I've been a number one, I've been a number two, I've been a number three, and I've been four, five, and six. But for my role, when I play, it's easy. You know, you train and you play, you get all the plaudits or you get all the criticism, but you get that release from game day. But as a number two, and particularly number three, to be able to have that mindset and work as hard as they do, we have Eldon. Wow, he's 37. Well, he's probably 45, but he's 37. But you'll hate me to say that. But no, but that 37, to have the drive to train at the intensity he does every day, it's incredible. And if he can do that, he sets the tone for every goalkeeper at the club. Because if he can do that, the youngsters, they've got to be following that. They've not even just got to be following, they've got to be out doing that. If he's setting the benchmark up here, you've got to be at the bare minimum matching him. And that's, you know, to have someone like that, that takes unique character to be able to have such internal drive. Because people will look at that, oh, he's just happy not playing. Like, it's not the case. I've never met a number three or a number two that's happy not playing. They all want to play, but they accept that goalkeeping is unique, and they're not poisonous. They're the opposite. They're the lifeblood of a team, because they're the ones that step in for shooting practice when the youngsters aren't there. They're the ones who set that kind of tone, because if he can do it, his chances of playing are so small. If he can do it, everyone's got to be on it. Everyone's got to be on it. And that's what, for example, Eldon does. And you can see the youngsters, how they buy into it. You know, and he's great at taking the youngsters under his wing. I try sometimes, but like you say, when you play, you've got to be selfish sometimes and look after yourself and do what you need to do. I'll join them in the mornings for the bike sessions. I won't do the same as them, but, you know, I'll be in there with them. I'll do my own bike session, whatever, you know, it needs to be done for, leading up to a game or recovery from a game. But he'll be in there pushing them every day, you know, not because he's telling them to. You know, he's just, this is what I do. And you know, if you want to follow, you know, be my guest. And that's such a unique role. And I've got so much respect for anyone who can fulfill that role.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We spoke about it a lot on the last pod, because I just think that it's one that naturally for a recruitment team, that might be a little bit lower, which, you know, of course, they want to get their star striker, their number one goalkeeper, etc. But actually, where we've seen with Southampton in recent weeks, Brentford, it looks like, obviously, depending on how the next week or so plays out, the young goalkeeper they've got there, Matt Cox, might play. Like that number three role to get, because as you said there, it's, from outside looking in, you've got a keeper that may never play. But actually, everything you've just said there, if you've got ordinarily it is that slightly older goalkeeper who can set the tone, who can be a little bit of a bridge as well, potentially, between staff and players at a lot of clubs. So there's so much more to the role. And actually, when needed, to know that you've got someone who can step in and play three, four, five games, which the rules being what they are, you know, it could be vital. You know, you get injured in September, Danny Wall gets injured in September, he could end up playing 15 games. And again, if they're not that character, you can't go and get him an emergency loan. And that's where, again, it's a real niche subject, but I do think that for clubs that don't have that Eldon as a number three, then again, it could come back to bite you.
It is. It's so true. And the goalkeeping group is really important to me, because that's where I spend a lot of my time during the day. And to have someone like Eldon and Wardy, there's so much respect in there, because we've all played, we've all, you know, done great things in our career. Eldon is obviously at a different stage of his career than, for example, Wardy is. Eldon and I are a lot closer in age, but Eldon takes on a role of advising me on a lot of things, you know, and he'll watch the games and he'll pick up on things. And, you know, at halftime, he'll just mention a few things sometimes in the warm-up, you know, just remember what we talked about the other day, or remember he does this, just keep your mind on that, you know, and he contributes to me so much. And for me, to have that kind of support is vital. It helps me so much. And You know, that's why guys like him, they're so important to me, because they create the environment. And Eldon inspires me because, like I say, if he can do it, I have to be doing that. I have to be doing more. I'm never going to be doing less than what he's doing, you know. So he in many ways is a benchmark for the group. During COVID now, we haven't been allowed to have our two goalie coaches. We got obviously Mike Stowell and Glenn Thompson in the academy. We usually all train together. So when Mike's required for set pieces and different kind of things with the first team, Eldon will a lot of the time be left with the youngsters, and you know, you can see the effect he has on them. You know, he'll almost take that coaching role, which he does, you know, great. But to have that kind of relationship with your fellow goalkeepers and your goalie coach. Your goalie coach is so important in this. And you know, I was listening to Neil Cutler there on the other podcast, and I loved what he was saying is that it's not him imposing his will on you. It's a partnership. I've been so lucky in my life to have some incredible goalie coaches. You know, Tim Flowers was my first. I had Peter Benetti, but Pete, I was so young. Pete was obviously first team goalie coach. Tim came in, took an interest in me. Joe Hart as well, when he came in, and really spent time developing us. And it was a real blow when he left Man City. I was on loan at Falkirk at the time. I remember him calling me, telling me that he was leaving. And that was a real blow, because that was my close confidant. That was the guy, my go-to guy, basically for my development. That changed things. And it also became uncertain, because then what happens after? Who comes in? Will we be able to build the same relationship or not? You know, but I'm lucky that I've had two long-term goalkeepers. I've had three, but the two long-term goalie coaches that I've worked with on a daily basis have obviously been Mike at Leicester, and then Lars Hu, who, as I said before, sadly died last week from cancer. And those two have had such an influence on my life, not just my professional career, but they set the tone for the goalkeepers group, and both vastly, vastly different, because Stowley lets me get on with it. You know, he knows how analytical I am, and he knows how much work I put in pre and post game in analyzing. He knows how much work I do in the gym, because he's in there himself doing his own thing, because he's an animal. So when things need to be discussed, we'll discuss it in a certain way, and we don't really do the debrief, because I basically do that straight after the game anyway. So on the journey home from the game, usually, or as soon as I get home, you know, that's my debrief time. I'll watch the game straight away. And that will mean that when I wake up the next day, that game's gone. And I've moved on. With Lars, it was a very, very different relationship, in terms of Lars was my dad's number two for many years in the national team. But I knew Lars and his family from when I was basically a baby. I went on holiday with them. I went to school with his kids and things like that. And they meant a great deal to me personally. He meant a great deal to me personally. His family do. And when our relationship became a working relationship all of a sudden, initially we had to just find that balance, actually, at being personal friends and also being professional colleagues. That was a quick process, I felt. Lars knew how much I wanted it. And the first initial period where I didn't play, I think, was very difficult for Lars, because he knew my frustration at not playing, but he had to obviously get the first team goalkeeper ready. And that is such a skill, to manage the three egos like that. When you've got a hierarchy that isn't set, when you've got three number ones mentally, that is a minefield for a goalkeeper coach, because someone's always going to be angry. Someone's always going to be angry. And it's not always in a respectful way. There have been sessions where, you know, I felt incredibly uncomfortable when I was at number three or number two, because other people felt they should be playing, and, you know, and it can actually be really counterproductive. And that's where the practical psychologist of the goalkeeper coach comes in, because he sets that tone. And Lars set his tone in one way, and Mike in his way. Lars was extremely, extremely analytical, and he would have meetings with all the goalkeepers in the national team. He'd sit down and he'd interview you, basically. He'd do an hour and a half interview every time you met, about everything, how things were going, and he'd have files and files upon you, and he'd be able to go back, well, 3 years ago you were in this situation, where do you feel now compared to this? If I asked you the same question I asked you 3 years ago, you answered this back then, what do you think now? And that was, because it was so different to what I had with Mike, you know, that was also very, very helpful. His training was very, very technical, whereas Mike's is very practical. It's match situations, it's sharp, it's competition. So I was so, I got the best of both worlds, because I had the tech, the real, real nitty gritty technical aspects of everything, to the actual match situations with Mike. And I couldn't have asked for a better blend. The personalities, again, it's just so important that the goalkeeper coach is able to work with the number one, the number two, three, four, five, six down the line, and treat them all individually, because everyone's in a different situation, you know. And as a 35-year-old playing games every week, there's certain parts of training that I can't join, you know, where they need to, like, you know, not risk an injury and things like that. Whereas he has to manage people in that sense, and that's such a difficult, and that's what I really enjoyed about listening to Neil.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Great stuff. It's and again, there's so many goalkeeper coaches that do listen into this. And in fact, yeah, definitely, if you can get Mike Stowell on this podcast, we are going to leave you with that challenge. I mean, I've got one more question. I'm sure, Matt, you've probably got one or two more. But the one, again, we intended to touch on gloves, which we certainly did, leadership, which we've done. I think we've touched quite a bit on the young goalkeeper, moving into the older goalkeeper, which I suppose my last question is relating to that, in that you said something earlier which really made me think about young goalkeepers coming through and how passionate they'll be, how invested in their game, and how aligned they will be with their game. And I talk about this quite a bit, but obviously as a young goalkeeper coming through, you use the word roller coaster, and it can be. You have your great game, everyone's telling you you're fantastic. You have your bad game, no one seems to be talking to you in the changing room. You know, you make a mistake, you want the ground to swallow you up, all those cliches. But being so closely aligned to your game as a goalkeeper obviously can't work in the long term. You know, you've touched on that, where effectively you have to have the ability to judge yourself after a game. Like you say you do, you go and watch your game. But my guess is when you're watching it, you're not emotionally attached to what's going on. It's almost like it must be like you're watching a different person, and you're able to objectively analyze the goalkeeper that you're watching and be able to make changes, positive changes, so that you then improve as you move forward. At what point, or how do you do that? How do you advise for a young goalkeeper to not have that emotional attachment to their game and to be able to almost view themselves as the human being? That's them, that's whoever they are. And then themselves as the goalkeeper, a completely different entity.
That's something that's certainly really, really difficult to do. Emotional maturity in football is something that really fascinates me, because we are thrown into a system at a young age that doesn't allow you to mature that much emotionally, because everything's done for you. The only real responsibility you have is to play. So there's lots of things around your person, yourself. You don't get to experience, you know, football gives you incredible, it gives you so much, but it also robs you of your youth a little bit. There's so many things, so many personality things that you miss out on from not going to, for example, to college or to university and things like that. And you become this selfish entity, and it's all about you, because that's how you're brought up. You have to make it for yourself. So to detach yourself from that and actually look from the outside in is really, really difficult at a young age, I think. My kind of way of doing it is having my role models. Who do I want to be like? There's not one particular person, but you blend. So for me, it was a blend of my father. It was a blend of Oli Kahn, Cañizares, Iker Casillas. Nowadays, you know, Manuel Neuer, Edison, You know, these kind of keepers, they're the ones I now look at, Buffon, and think, right, this is what I want to model my game, my person, my leadership on. So when I look at me, do I see these traits in me? So that's how I kind of detach myself and compare it. So for example, I can give you an example business-wise. So in terms of like sponsorship and commercial activity outside of football, one of my big heroes in sport, but also in outside of sport, is Roger Federer. So the question I always pose myself when any kind of sponsorship deal or anything like that comes in is, would Roger Federer do it? So if the answer is yes, then I do it. If the answer is no, then I don't do it. And the same kind of thing with goalkeeping. Would Neuer do that? Or would Edison do that? Or would Casillas have done that? Then I can kind of see where I want to go. But I've also had a very, very clear idea, because I watched goalkeeping, you know, from when I remember, and I studied it so much, and I was lucky enough to go to training and watch my dad so closely. So I studied goalkeeping so much, and I had a good idea of what I thought would work for me, my body type, my size, my competences. So when I analyze a game, I look at those things that I just mentioned. I look at what is the manager asking me to do, and do I bring what I want to bring to the team? And these are the kind of questions I sit and ask myself when I watch the games. I used to do it a lot more when I was young. I used to take a lot more time with it. Now we're playing games every 3 days or so. You know, that's why I say you've got to move on quick. From great results and bad results, you've got to move on quick, which is why I do it quickly after the game. That means I can go to bed. So when I go to bed on a good result, bad result, wherever it may be, the day after is a new day, and we've moved on from that. That day, if you win, you celebrate that win, because you never know when your next one's going to come. So enjoy that night. Enjoy it. Do whatever you need to do, but really enjoy it. And then next day, you move on. And the thing about detaching yourself also is getting away, particularly from a young age, getting away from football, because football is so all-encompassing. And you only see the you know, people want to see the money side and all this, that, and the other. But it is so emotionally draining to be a football player, to be a goalkeeper, because it is such a roller coaster, the word you used. So to me, you've got to find something that takes you away from football, your mind away. My dad always said to me, you got to learn, you know, learn how to play an instrument, do something like that. And I was, no, I want to start, I spend my time wanting to do all this. And it's only in the last few years where I've taken up the guitar and actually see what it is he means. So after a game, regardless of the result, yeah, I'll just sit and play guitar, and your mind just wanders away, and an hour and a half went by, you know. And usually, maybe if you've lost that hour and a half, you're sitting there angry and frustrated. And because when I was young, if you lost the game, 3-4 days after, I'd still be in a horrendous mood. But growing up, learning things away from, you know, getting yourself away from the game, whatever that is, having kids, being, you know, having family, these things take you away from football, which is healthy, because football can swallow you up. It can be your whole life. You can't switch on the TV without football being on. And my life has changed a lot growing up. Like, I used to watch every game religiously, and it was great. There'd be 3-4 games on a day, and I'd watch anything. And I'd study it, and I'd watch Sky Sports News 24/7 and all that. But then when you start being in that world, wow, your head just, you can't handle that much information, because the amount of meetings you have already about team, about this, about that, the other, and the older you get, when you become a captain, these things, the responsibility, it becomes so much that now actually my life has changed in the sense that I don't just come home and switch the TV on anymore. Because I can't actually handle listening to that anymore. I can't listen to football anymore than what my tolerance is. So when I go to training, I flip the switch. I'm fully focused on that day in training. I'm getting better and what I want to do that day and what I want to accomplish. But when I step inside my house, then we're done. Now I'm a dad, I'm a husband. You know, I have responsibilities. I have things I have to do. You know, I have things outside of football. And then obviously day before games, you're different. You know, you get into a certain mindset and you prepare in a certain way. But generally having that thing of getting away from the game has become really important, because you can't go anywhere without people knowing who you are and what happened in that game. And if you've made a mistake or you had a bad result, you're looking at people thinking they know, you know, that they know I messed up, or they know I had a bad game. And quite the opposite, you know, they know if you've, you know, if you had a great game. And that's all well and good, but that's your life. It's 24/7. So having something that can get you away from that as well. So kind of putting a limit on how much you analyze, I think, is important as well, because you can overanalyze and that becomes then obsessive and then it becomes counterproductive. So finding something away from the game, really, really important. That's one thing. If I could tell any youngster to find something, don't play computer and all that rubbish. Get away from that. Actually do something, learn a language or like I say, learn an instrument or find something that's going to take you away from the screen, going to take you away from football, but something that will give you something in life. Because imagine one day if you get an offer to play in Italy and all of a sudden you can speak Italian, you know, because you learned it before, you know, or you get an Italian defender in front of you and all of a sudden you can speak to this guy better than anyone. That can be the difference between you playing or not. If the keeper behind you speaks fluent Italian, he's got two Italian defenders in front of him, that might be the difference. Who knows? You know, so learn a life skill. Get off Twitter, Instagram, all that rubbish. Get away from the screens. Get away from that and find something fun to do.
Completely agree. Completely agree with all of that. Now, I don't know whether there's ever been a 24-hour podcast, but this could quite easily be, we could probably talk for hours. There is loads of stuff. Like Richard said, you said I've probably got a few more questions. I'm going to nip them in the bud and save it for next time, I think, when we do a 3, maybe a 4, a 5 and a 6, because the analysis stuff, which we didn't really get into in the last podcast and we haven't really touched on this time, so I think we'll leave that. I've just got a couple of quick fire ones for you. The first one, you said about a guitar, you play the guitar. Yeah. A chosen go-to, is it just general strumming or do you have a particular song that you like to play?
I think when you start learning, you know, you start obviously like Wonderwall and that kind of thing. My grandfather was a musician, professional musician. My dad's a musician. My dad plays every instrument you can possibly imagine. And he's one of those annoying people that you tell him a song and he can play it without even hearing it. Or he'll hear 10 seconds of a song and then he can play it. It's, you know, when you realize how difficult guitar is, that's so frustrating. But I just like playing. I've always loved singing. So I just sit and play, sing. You know, and then just basically have a good time with it. It's just a bit of fun.
A beautiful thing. Okay. The next one, Roger Federer. You mentioned him there. Have you had the chance to meet him?
Not yet. Not in person. I have been to a couple of his games. I went to a few of his games in the O2 Arena. And yeah, not had the pleasure yet, but hopefully one day.
Okay. And lastly, you mentioned NFL. We spoke about it a bit off air at the beginning. I don't know whether you saw last night, but the Panthers had their kicker get injured in the pre-game warm-up. Now, the clip that went on Twitter of the tryouts, ridiculous, absolutely awful. I think we touched on this with might have been Asmir Begovic, who's also a huge NFL fan. Is that ever anything that might be on your radar post-career? Or do you think it's something that professional footballers, and particularly goalkeepers, should look at going to the NFL and being a kicker?
It'd be great, wouldn't it? But again, I think we underestimate how hard that really is. So I'll go back. Morten Andersen, I don't know if you've ever heard of him. I think he's just been overtaken, but he was the top point scorer ever in NFL history. 26-year career. In the NFL, 24-year career in the NFL, a Danish guy who, you know, played for the Atlanta Falcons, the New Orleans Saints. He came over on a soccer scholarship, and they needed a kicker in the team. And all of a sudden, he was an NFL kicker. But the level of detail that he had about kicking this ball is exactly the same as goalkeeping. So I think it would be a little bit like saying to a wide receiver who catches a ball and dives around to go in goal. I think we underestimate how difficult it really is. I've kicked an NFL ball a few times, and yeah, I can do it, but the consistency, that is years and years and years of practice. Again, I don't know. This is something I've always thought about that could be fun, but wow, when you look at someone like Justin Tucker at the Baltimore Ravens and you see the consistency he has, I'm not sure how, I think it's something like 60, 65 field goals in a row he's kicked. But to do that, you ask a goalkeeper to hit a goal kick a certain play 65 times, they can't do it. And that's with a round ball, you know? So, and this is so much about timing and process. I think it's a lot more difficult than we give it credit for, but it's certainly something I'd love to try.
I'm thinking you could change the technique of the punt to a nice side volley with an NFL ball. I'd love to see
that. That is one thing that I have thought about, is that I think a goalkeeper would be good at because they kick it a certain way. I think you could do that. And I don't know if you remember David James, particularly in his later years, he used to actually punt the ball in the same way, the same process. And he loved NFL. He was big into NFL as well.
Excellent. Great way to finish. Thoroughly enjoyed this one. Yet again, Kasper Schmeichel, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.